Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Literary Studies, a channel on the New Books Podcast Network. I'm your host, Britt Edelin, and today we have as our guest, Anna Vaprinska.
Hi, Britt. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. And today we're going to be talking to Anna about her recently published book, Empathy in Contemporary Poetry After Crisis. It's a great read, and I think a really prescient one. And before we do that, I'm just going to say a few words about our guest. So Anna is a current SSHRC postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto. Her book, the book we're discussing today, Empathy in Contemporary Poetry After Crisis, was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2020 and was just shortlisted for the MSA First Book Award. Anna has articles published in Contemporary Literature and the Bristol Journal of English Studies, and has also published the full-length poetry collection, Sew with Butterflies, and the poetry chapbook, Spirit Clenched. She holds an SSHRC-funded PhD in English from York University, where she won the dissertation prize, and a master's in English from the University of Oxford, and has taught courses at York University, Seneca College, and the postdoctoral school, and the poetry school. Oh my gosh, so many slips of the tongue.
Words are so hard.
Just lots of P's. So welcome to the show, Anna. It's super exciting to have you here, and I'm really looking forward to discussing your book with you. And before we get into the book itself, can you give us a little bit more of your intellectual or academic background and how that related to the origins and the product of this book?
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for the introduction, Britt. And I guess the way there are multiple pathways into how this book came to be. My academic background is all of my degrees were in English literature. I did my undergrad at York University, and that's actually where I first encountered Paul Celan, the poet Paul Celan, whom I know you also, is a poet who also speaks to you, Britt. I discovered Paul Celan in a course run by Bruce Pau called Visionary Literature. And I think, so Paul Celan appears in the book, but Paul Celan was also the focus of my master's thesis. And His poetry really spoke to me, and it spoke to me especially because of the way in which I first read him. So I'll say a little bit more about that. So when I was in Bruce Pau's class, we were reading, and I think Psalm might have been the poem that we're reading, which is the poem that appears in the book. And the way that Bruce had us read that poem was really slowly, like with emphasis to every single word. And so he'd have one person read, and then he'd say, okay, can someone else read that, but slower? And this happened like multiple times until almost you were pausing almost after every word. And Edmond Jabez has, the poet Edmond Jabez has a quote about this. He says, silence, as all writers know, allows the word to be heard. And it was a moment in which, even though I'd loved poetry since I was a child, and writing poetry pretty much coincided with me learning English and learning to speak, and learning to write. And so it feels pretty ingrained in who I am. But I think that moment of reading Celan that slowly and paying attention, and you know he's a poet where each word is so pressurized, it's each word has carries so much meaning, whether it's historical, cultural, political, etc. And so Paul Celan was part of my entryway into poetry after crisis and poetry after the Holocaust, which is one of the crises I consider in the book. The other way I came to, the way I came to empathy was actually also in an, it was in a PhD course this time. So I was at York, and it was Leslie Higgins's city text class. And I wrote my final essay for that class. It was a modernist essay on Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway and Duna Barnes's Nightwit. And in that essay, I considered the doctors in those texts. And I'm sure you recall, but so the doctor in Mrs. Dalloway is somebody who is so unempathetic, so removed from trying to understand the effective landscape of the characters, the other characters' worlds. And then versus the doctor in Nightwood, he's somebody who's so overly empathetic, who just like takes on other people's pain so easily and effortlessly, but almost to a point of appropriating it. And I'm sure we'll talk about how empathy can appropriate later in this chat. And in the essay, I talked about how neither kind of empathy, whether this very understated empathy or this overly abundant empathy, could lead to any kind of healing. And that's kind of where my thinking about empathy began. And then, yeah, I guess putting together those various interests with Celan, with crisis poetry, with empathy is kind of how the book came to be. And of course, I guess like in terms of the Holocaust, my own family history, my family is Jewish, I'm Jewish, and there's a long line of history of people and even stories that we don't know the conclusions to. We can just assume of people who were in the Holocaust and suffered. And so in various ways. So I guess those different pathways are what brought me to this book.
Thank you for that. I think you've kind of touched on a lot of what I think is important about this book, in that I think empathy is a big problem, or a problematic that a lot of literary studies is looking at today. And I think you add a lot to the conversation, and crisis is such a big word. And I think that's where I want to begin. Probably with those two words, crisis and empathy, two words that show up in the title of your book. And I want to move backwards. So we'll start with crisis and then go to empathy. So can you define how you're seeing the word crisis and how it's deployed in the text? You bring in trauma theory. So for example, Shoshana Fellman and Kathy Carruth as kind of these big names that help us to define traumatic experience or trauma theory within literature. And that's where you start the conversation of crisis. And I'm just wondering if you can provide a little definition of what you think crisis is, and then talk about why you chose the three crises that you did, which you mentioned the Holocaust. And then the other two are 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina.
Okay, thank you so much for that question. So I think of crisis, and I'll try to answer it as best I can. And it makes me think about whether I did define crisis in the book. It's all these things you think about after. But I think of crisis as a crux, as a point, a pressurized point, as something happens. And the way I conceived it in the book was I looked at public cultural crises. But a crisis could also be personal, of course. The reasons for choosing the public crisis was because of the vast array of poetry available to those. So that was part of that reason. But that's not to say that the personal crisis, the kinds of work that I do with the poetry in this book, doesn't apply to the personal. I think it does. And so, I mean, these are thoughts for a potential other book. But in terms of why I chose these three crises, I guess these three pressurized points, trauma, like of things going wrong in a way, of potential trauma for the people involved. The reason I chose these three was because of the incomparable, and I talk about this in the book as well, of the incomparable nature of crises events themselves. So how do you choose three to talk about? It's almost impossible to choose because each one is so incomparable. Each one, even though you could say you could compare one genocide to another, each one holds its own stories, its own individualized accounts, its own poetries. And so part of the reason they're so different, these crises, is because I wanted them to be different. I wanted to compare three things that you wouldn't think to really compare, something like the Holocaust, something like 9/11, and something like Hurricane Katrina. And part of the reason of choosing those specific three as well was because the object of my study was empathy. And I wanted to understand, how does empathy work in different contexts? When you place it in different contexts under different pressure, how does it look? How does it articulate itself? And so that's why I chose a genocide, a terrorist attack, and then a natural disaster, but one that's, of course, amplified by racial and class politics. So I hope that answers it. That's kind of where those three came from. And I talk a bit about in the introduction and in the conclusion about the discomfort of having three Western crises and the problems of translation, the opportunities of translation. And so, yeah, in a way, they're arbitrary choices in the same way that crises are incomparable, and these crises are incomparable, but in another way, they're chosen to show the different ways that empathy works after three very different events.
Yeah, I think something you do in this book is give us some kind of a scaffolding for thinking about other crises and the incomparability of crisis. It reminds me, Jacques Derrida's book, The Work of Mourning, which is a collection of his elegies or eulogies given for his friends who passed away as he lived on and longer than the rest. In French, the original title is Chaque fois unique, la fin du monde. Each time unique, the end of the world. And I think that's a way to describe crisis. It's every time it happens, it's unique. So in some way, a collection of three, any three would have worked. And I think what you can do with your book is kind of think about other crises and what kinds of poetry come after them. So now we can move to the important word in your text, which is empathy. This is a hard word. I think it has such an interesting history and common misconceptions and historical misconceptions. Can you draw out what your working definition of empathy is, and maybe talk a little bit about the history of the word? It has an interesting translational history, and I think maybe compare it to other forms of recognition of the other, or perhaps identification, that's a word you bring up, or even sympathy, which is another concept very closely tied to empathy, but different.
Okay, I will try to do that. There are a lot of questions there. So of course, empathy is a word I struggled with throughout this book. And I think, like, we began this interview and I think I said words are so hard, and I think they are. Because of what you say, like, there's a history that they carry, there are connotations they carry, that are much bigger than looking up empathy in the dictionary. So I guess I'll begin a bit with that history and then I'll move into the definition. So empathy is a word that came out of German aesthetics. So it's interesting to think about the location, the field from which empathy came, and it didn't come through psychology or sociology, which are fields in which we often see empathy come up now, or history. So it's interesting that it came out of an aesthetics field, and it was translated. It was only translated into English in 1909 from the German word Einfühlung. And so thinking about that, it's only about a century old, this word. And so that's very interesting to think about. And in the introduction of the book, I also talk about how empathy came to be in English around the same time that the word trauma also came to be. And then it's just interesting tied, like, conceptual and historical arising of these two words. And empathy, the way empathy has been defined and the way the definition with which I work through in the book is thinking of it as both an imaginative, so a cognitive, and affective projection of the self into another. And when we talk about empathy colloquially, we often will reference the metaphor, put yourself into somebody else's shoes. And actually, I'll just veer off to just share a really interesting anecdote. When I was in June 2017, there was a conference run by the European Society for Literature, Arts and Science. And the title of the conference, the theme of the conference was empathies. So empathy in the plural. And one of the things that this conference did, and I was writing the conclusion when I went to this conference, but it was there was so much richness that came out of it, and there were so many fields represented in it, and it made me really think about, like, everything I had written in a new light. And so that conference was really great. But why I brought it up is because there was a pair of shoes. At the front of the main room of the conference, there was a pair of shoes that were on display to speak to this metaphor of to walk into someone else's shoes. And one of the things that the conference organizer said was, at any point during this conference, you're free to take off your shoes and exchange them for whichever ones are on this podium at the moment. So it's this idea of physically iterating that metaphor of to walk in somebody else's shoes. So I thought that was a really interesting touch. And it also reminds me of, I haven't looked into this in a while, but there's an empathy museum. And one of the things they do is have you try on different people's shoes, which is really interesting. So I don't know. It's just interesting for me to consider how metaphor and how language can be taken into this very, into the physicality, into its, like, physical being. And so, this idea of walking in somebody else's shoes, of projecting yourself into another, is the way I see empathy. I also see it as a kind of openness, as a way of opening to another person, and an openness that runs both ways between self and other. The poet Frank Bidart, he calls empathy, and this was actually the title of the book in its first iteration, back when it was a dissertation. The beginning of the title was The Skin of Another, and Frank Bidart says, sees empathy as the imagination to enter the skin of another. And so this idea of entry, of openness, of projection, is all part of this idea of empathy. That said, I develop, so in the book, I develop the concept of empathetic dissonance. And I'm going to stop there because I'm sure you'll ask me about it. It's a concept that basically questions empathy and doesn't just take for granted, which I think a lot of us do. Like if you haven't studied empathy or I guess if you haven't thought about the very like power relations in that empathy constitutes, right, between empathizer and object of empathy, you'll often think of empathy as a very ethical relation, which it of course can be, but it isn't always, and that's what empathetic dissonance addresses.
Thank you. That your anecdote about the conference is so interesting, and I think one of the things you bring up in the text is that there's a danger in empathy of losing the self too much, and the constant recognition that there's a difference between self and other. And while you mm-hmm. were mentioning that anecdote, I was thinking of, you know, what if you took off your shoes and put them up on the platform and then someone took your shoes and then you just wouldn't have shoes. So there's a fear involved in empathy, or a risk taking. And I think something that many of these poems do is jump headfirst into that risk, and force us to confront both the separation between ourselves and others and the possibility that, you know, we can get all the way to one another.
Yes, of course. And just to go off what you said, also this idea that what if the shoes you take don't fit? So that's in empathy too, this idea. And I could talk a bit about empathetic dissonance if you would like me to.
Yeah, I think that would be great before we get deeper into the chapters.
Yeah, so I guess this is the concept I saw happening in these works. So empathetic dissonance, if empathy is this process of projecting yourself into other, then empathetic dissonance is a process that both invites empathy and refuses it. So it's a process that both commends it and condemns it, because it recognizes that empathy is both ethical, both something that's an ethical relation toward another, and it's something that can be unethical and something that can be a violence. And so there's a pull and toward and a push away from empathy. And we can think of it almost as empathy is both bridge, but empathy is also bruise. I guess in metaphorical terms, that's the way I kind of think about it. And this empathetic dissonance is what I see these poems displaying, both wanting empathy, wanting understanding from another, wanting that entry into the self, but also pushing it away, realizing that, like you said, that gulf of empathy, and Sarah Ahmed coins that term, gulf of empathy. So this distance between the self and other, and these various problematics of empathy that we can talk about further as well.
So I think we'll be able to go into the chapters, and I think you'll be able to open up more empathetic dissonance within them. So your three chapters, or I guess the three categories that you're looking at, there's a tripartite structure, which in each one has a tripartite structure based on the crises. So the first one, I think, was the most obvious, and it's the unsaid. And I think something that we get from trauma theory and from many thinkers following the Holocaust is that there's an inability to speak to the violence of that crisis, and I think in general, lots of crises. Maybe that's like one of the constitutive definitions of crisis, that there's an unspeakability or a failure of language. So can you talk about unsaid or unspeakable, or that which is beyond language, and perhaps give us a way to think about how poetry can put the unsaid in the said? You write, or you quote poet Kelly Cherry, who says that, "I believe in the power of language to show, to move, to solve, to heal, to build. I believe that nothing is beyond language, or rather that the nothing, capital N, that is beyond language is containable with art. I believe that that is what art is for, to contain the nothing that is beyond language.
Mm-hmm. Later she actually says that I believe this and am without words. So that's quite interesting. Okay, I was just taking notes as you were writing. As you were speaking. So it's an interesting question, and you're right that it's the most obvious because I think that's part of the reason it comes first, because it's something that so many poetic, but also non-poetic literary responses, all sorts of literary responses after crises speak to. This inability to speak after a crisis, or to find the words with which to speak. And at the same time, there's so much written after a crisis, and writing is often something that people turn to, or artistic expression after a crisis. And just to illustrate that, it reminded me of something I read in actually one of the anthologies after 9/11. The fire department issued a statement after 9/11, and they said, "Thank you for the food and the blankets, but please no more poetry." And it was a response to poetry that had been strewn around all of New York City. So this idea that even though we grapple with how do we describe, how do we speak, there's a poet I was just listening to, Jacob Rosenberg, and he says, how do you find the language to describe it? What alphabet do you employ? And of course, Celan struggles with that and invents words and compounds words and breaks down the language and remakes the language. And so many other poets struggle with that. But then at the same time, there's this proliferation of writing that happens after crises. So it's an interesting tension that happens. And I was also thinking about, of course, Adorno when you were talking. And Adorno said to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. And I talk about a bit in the book about how so many people interpret that to mean you can't write after Auschwitz, or you can't write after these big traumas, these big crises, because what happens to language? How do you use the same language that was used in the perpetuation of these traumas to describe it? And what I think Adorno meant, and what I see in Celan's work and others, is that you can write after a crisis. It's just that the work is different. The work carries, and Celan says it, I think it was speech went through, or words or language went through the thousand darknesses of death bringing speech. And so this idea that you carry that history, that trauma, you write through an awareness of those. So it's not that you can't write after, it's just that the poetry or the whatever literary response you have isn't the same because it's been affected by this. And I'm also reminded of Charlotte Delbeau and her incredible memoir, Auschwitz and After. And what she keeps saying in that memoir is that we don't speak in the same language. Like once you've been, like the language of the camps is not the same language after the camps. So when you or me say we're hungry, or we're starving, or we're thirsty, that's not what those words meant in the camps, right? So there's a big gap, even though we have the same words, there's a big gap in what these words actually mean. And in one poem she says, you, and she often uses this apostrophe you to invite us in, but also kind of to keep us out. And that's the sympathetic dissonance. So she says, you want to know, you ask questions, you want to know, and I'm probably misquoting, but then she says, we don't know how to answer, not with the words you use. And so it goes to this idea of there being really a gap in the meaning of words between when you're in these very, I guess, limit events like the Holocaust, like 9/11, like Hurricane Katrina, where the language can take on very different meanings than it does in the everyday. And it goes back to, I guess, this word crisis again.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think what you just bring up with, you talk about the apostrophe. You talk about apostrophe as a figure that is central to a lot of the poetry that comes out of crises. And apostrophe for listeners who might not know, it's like the O, west wind. It's you are giving you're personifying or bringing into being the reader or the listener who you're speaking to. And I think it's related to the deictic, which is having to give vocabulary lessons, this is so hard. But a deictic is a word like we or you or I or here and there. And I think you carry the deictic conversation throughout the text, but they shift based on who's speaking. There's no set definition for a deictic. And I'm wondering, how do you see the deictic or the apostrophe in relation to the unspeakability or the unanswerability of speech in relation to crisis? Because there's a huge difference, as we know, between experiencing the Holocaust or the 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina and reading about it. And I'm wondering if you can say a few words about empathy and the deictic and that relationship to language.
Mm-hmm. I think the deictic, it's such an interesting concept because it's almost secret in a way, unless you know what the referent is, right? It's there are words that change in context, right? And when you say, so that example I gave of the Holocaust poets who says, how do you describe it? What is the it, right? And it's almost you're invited into a secret when in order to try and decipher what is it in the context of what the poet is writing. And so the deictic, in terms of empathy, it's almost an invitation in, but it's also a push away, because if you don't know what it refers to, you're pushed away. And then actually so I'll give another example of one of the poems I look at in the book. I look at Claudia Rankine's Citizen, and specifically the Hurricane Katrina poem in that text. And don't have that quote in front of me, but one of the things, the language becomes very disjointed there. And there's this one that keeps being referenced, one. And so you don't know exactly who that one is, and you feel you're almost, it's empathetic in the sense of you're invited into this kind of chaotic world of trying to figure out how to get your family and yourself out of this very critical situation of Hurricane Katrina. But you're not sure of who this one is, and is one the same one every time one is referenced, or does one change every time one is spoken about? And so I think there's it's almost like the dialectic is like a carrier for empathetic dissonance, because it has this both invitation and this very cautious potential rejection if you don't know or don't understand or can't figure out what the referent is. I hope that answers that a bit.
Yeah. So I'd like to move on to another dialectic, which is the next chapter, which is entitled The Unhear. And so here is another dialectic. It's, if I say here, I mean, you know, Durham, North Carolina, in my chair at my desk with everything open in front of me, all that I have crowding my desk. And when I say you're there, Anna's there, that's a different there, but you can say I'm here and that's where you are and I'm there and that's where I am. So it functionally, it just keeps changing. And I'm wondering, can you speak a little bit about how hearness and distance relates to empathetic dissonance within the poetry that you're analyzing?
Okay, that's actually a really excellent question. Thank you. And I love that you gave the example of your here versus my here. And to each of us, they're heres, but to the other, they're theirs. If that makes sense. So thinking about how even language, even in language, like we can't fully empathize with each other because your here can't be my here unless I physically like put myself in the here that you are, and even that can shift, right? So I already lost the question. Yeah, so unhear and empathetic dissonance. Is that what the question was? So in terms of crises, so the second chapter titled The Unhear, it looks at, I guess, removed witnessing. So a lot of the poetry that I look at there are witnesses that didn't necessarily have a firsthand experience of a particular crisis, but write about it nonetheless. So like, for example, the Polish poet was Lois Zimborska, her poet photograph from September 11th. So her here is very, she's unhere in the crisis. And I think I talk a bit about why I called it unhere as opposed to unthere, because it puts the pressure on the here, this idea of the here as the position of the person in the crises. And if you're unhere, if you're not, I guess, there, you're at a removed position. And I think this is what I was going to say, that nearness and distance are so much a part of empathy. And Rebecca Solnit, who's another entry point into this book, and I begin with her words, from the book, The Far Away Nearby, right? And in that book, she talks all about empathy and how empathy is a process of both trying to get yourself towards another, so trying to reduce the distance between you and another, but at the same time, not being able to reduce that distance. So you're both trying to be near, but at the same time, you're far, going back to that gulf of empathy that Sarah Ahmed describes.
I think something that is brought up in your text, as well as in the idea of a dialectic, is that here is, when you're reading a text, you have a here, and it's different from the here of the poem, especially in poems that are talking about the Holocaust or 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina, because those are separated from us either geographically or temporally. I can't ever go to the here of the camp or the here of New Orleans or the here of New York during 9/11. But I think there's a fear that comes in that's, it could happen here. And I think that's what a lot of the empathy tries to suggest. But what I'd like to ask you now is, how do you think the un is functioning to make hear unhear? And how does that relate to empathetic dissonance within poetry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I talk a bit about that un as well. And the reason they all begin with uns is because I kind of wanted to keep that tension and to point at that unrest and that tension within crisis. And like within those two words that you pointed out as like rightly, like these bookended parts of the title, Empathy in Contemporary Poetry After Crisis, but also as these very like important terms in this work, they hold this tension. Empathy holds a tension, as we discussed. Empathetic dissonance holds a tension, and crisis holds tension. And by keeping that un at the center, it was a way of articulating that tension, that it was about the unsaid. And one of the things I talk about in the conclusion is maybe that kind of tips it over. It tips it over right into that and that unrest, not just so the in the unsaid, I talk about both the unsaid and the said, but by of course privileging the unsaid as the title of the chapter, it may tip that analysis towards that unsaid, if that makes sense. But the un is something that was meant to keep the unrest and the difficulty of these texts.
Thank you. And I one more question on in this chapter. So something you bring up is that this is in this chapter, the texts you look at are not from the crisis, but they represent some kind of a crisis of witnessing, which I think is something that you bring up, that there's a real role to the witness and to someone who hears testimony and then must do something with it. There's that unease of hearing something or reading something so effective about a crisis that it's hard to, like, you don't know what to do with it. And so you give it to others to bear almost. And I'm wondering, can you say something about perhaps the gesture of responsibility within the hearness, within the practice of witnessing or listening to another? And I think that goes to talk to the distance. Is there a responsibility, an ethical imperative in that distance and within the fact of crisis?
Yes, thank you so much for that question. And I think it's an important one. And yes, I do think there's a responsibility when writing about crises, especially, and that responsibility just becomes, larger when that crisis isn't, I guess, quote unquote, yours. And of course, that's another dialectic term, and the one that would need figuring out. But yes, I think that there is a responsibility when writing about crisis to not do something destructive, to not overstep. The way empathy can step into another's shoes, it can also overstep its boundaries, overstep another. It can be, and theorists like Sadia V. Hartman and Jonathan Boyeron have referred to empathy as a kind of symbolic violence, as the violence of identification, because sometimes when you step into another, imagine yourself into another, it can become all about you. And then you can shift that emotional focus from that object of empathy to yourself. Empathy can become this very appropriative act. I think there is a responsibility when witnessing, whether in writing or otherwise, and responding to a crisis, again, especially one that you are a secondary witness to not do harm. And I think it's very hard, like on a practical level, I think it's very hard to do that. And I've seen it, like, and I talk about in the book about how I've seen it done in like a way that has left me, at least as a reader, feeling so uncomfortable. And I'm talking here about specifically Susan Berkland's Jesus poem. One of the things she says in that poem, so the poem is basically about, for those of you who haven't read it, she imagines it's a response to 9/11. She imagines herself, or her, let's say, speaker, the poem speaker, into the towers on the day of 9/11. And she says, if I had been in one of those towers, and she uses it to affirm her Christian faith. But one of the things she says that at least rubbed me really the wrong way in the poem is she says, I don't know what I would be feeling, but I... let me try and remember it. It falls out of your head when you want it. Oh, she said, but I wouldn't be angry. She says, I don't know what I would be feeling, but I'm sure I wouldn't be angry. And I thought that kind of very certain kind of empathy that didn't leave room for anger, which is a very, like, I guess a very appropriate response to a victim of 9/11, is something that she kind of does away with. And so I think in a way, like, that poem oversteps the boundaries. And it does exactly what Boyren and Hartman are talking about when they called empathy a kind of symbolic violence. And Leslie Jamison, in her book, Empathy Exams, she also talks about, and she coins a word called empathy. So this idea that she uses it when she talks about her brother, and she says, I took on his suffering so much that it became about me. So empathy instead of empathy. And I'm not sure if that answers it, but I think those are the kind of things I'm thinking about when it comes to responsibility and the ways in which that responsibility can go astray, I suppose. And of course, there's so many other examples I can give from that chapter, especially with Reznikov, who he like chisels poetry out of the courtroom transcripts of the Nuremberg and Eichmann trials. And so that's really interesting because it's the words aren't his, but all the editorial choices are his. And he chooses to remove names, all the names. He chooses to switch from first to third person. He removes all the literary figures of speech because his concern, like the courtroom's concern, is a focus on facts over emotions. Cynthia Hogg and Rebecca Ross in their Hurricane Katrina interview poems and photographs also do a similar kind of work where they interview survivors of Katrina and they and photograph them and the words are all the survivors' words, but the way they're arranged on the page, what's chosen to be included in interviews that were like many pages long, but poems that turn out to be two or three pages long, it's all editorial choice. And so as that secondary witness, you do have a responsibility to those for whom you're speaking, right? Not to ventriloquize them, but to do so with an empathy that doesn't overstep, or with a kind of compassion, if we're going to use a different word, if empathy isn't exactly right, which is something I struggle with as well.
Yeah, I was reminded of Tadeusz Różewicz. He's a poet writing after World War II, and he says that after World War II and the terrors and the violences of it, we must create poetry that is made not of verses, but of facts. And he, in a lot of his poems, he uses newspaper clippings. And I think the idea of ventriloquization and empathy, what you bring out, and the idea of witnessing, is that the poet must not ventriloquize for the victim. Rather, they should be ventriloquized by them, to let their voices speak through in some way. And I think that's a really powerful idea, to let the survivors speak, or let the victims speak, because they were not able to in some way.
Yes.
So you bring up a poem called, what was it, Jesus? What was the poem titled?
A Jesus poem. I just wanted to say something to what you said. It's okay. It just reminded me of Brad Beckler, who writes after Hurricane Katrina and was affected by Katrina, and how he calls his collection of poetry documentary. He says it's called When Will the Sky Fall, Hurricane Katrina, a documentary in poetry. Mm. And this like very, where is poetry on the line between fact and fiction, right? And where do we fit it in when it's about crisis? And what about documentary? And what about imagination? And so all these kind of questions just like bubbling to the surface. But you go ahead, Britt.
Well, I bring up the Jesus poem and the poet's relationship to Christianity because I think that's a great way to get into your last chapter, which is called, it's so powerful, it's The Un-God. Can you explain your concept of the un-God? I think in relation to perhaps the idea, like a deistic formulation of God as a, you know, the watchmaker who just sets things in motion and then watches from afar, as opposed to also an atheistic, that there is no God. So how does the un-God kind of fit into that as opposed to those two figures?
Mm-hmm. So the way I conceive of this un-God is kind of, I guess, in two ways. And I talk about this in this chapter is that, un-God is, it can be an, a kind of atheism. So the belief that God doesn't exist. And then, of course, within that belief, there are two beliefs, whether God never existed or God no longer exists, which is sometimes kind of the response you see after a crisis, like after an event like the Holocaust, this response that, oh, is there a God if that could happen? But not always, right? And then the second way I conceive it that is that un-God can be it can be part of a theistic belief. So the belief in God does exist, but the individual refuses this relationship with God or believes that God refuses this relationship with the individual. So this idea that I guess God either does or doesn't exist in the un-God based on it's still through the eyes of that individual.
Thank you. That's a great explication of that. It's a very hard thing to think about. And I think, God comes up so often when we think of poetry of crisis. And we say it normally in our everyday language when we talk about crisis, like, how could God let that happen? How could God mm-hmm. do that? Or is there a God? Or all those questions of, we want something, we want this to have reason. And with senseless violence, it almost seems to kill God in a Nietzschean formation. Mm-hmm. But I want to take it to the poems. And I think my favorite part of this is where you talk about Psalm, and you mentioned that in the beginning. So I'll let you kind of talk about what you're doing there. If you don't mind, I'd love to read the first two stanzas of Paul Celan's poem, Psalm.
Of course, I would love that.
So this is Paul Celan's poem, Psalm. I'll read it in German and then in English. Psalm. Niemand knetet uns wieder aus Erde und Lehm. Niemand bespricht unseren Staub. Niemand. Gelobt seist du, niemand. Dir zu lieb wollen, wir blühen. Dir entgegen. So in English, that would read, no one needs us again out of earth and clay. No one summons our dust. No one. Blessed art thou, no one. In thy sight would we bloom. In thy spite. I'll turn it over to you, but I think what you're trying to get out of this is that Celan's notion of God as niemand, as no one, and the un-God are similar. So Can you say a little bit more about what you're trying to do in this reading, as well as a reading of his poem Tenebrae?
Yes, of course. And like I said, Selena's kind of the entry point. And this poem especially is one of the entry points into this work. So I'm glad you brought it up. And what I think Selena's doing, and I mean, there's an endless array of possibilities, especially with Selena. But this idea of no one, and this capitalized no one especially. So when we say no one, right, it's just part of our everyday language, but when no one becomes capitalized, then God becomes no one, right? This action of kneading us again out of earth and clay. There is no Genesis in this poem, and especially in this first stanza. So there's no one there. So there's physically nobody there to bring us back to life. But then there's also that no one, that nobody that's there also becomes a physical presence, this on God, this capitalized no one. And if God is no one, then it's in the very name, the absence is what's highlighted, that God isn't there, niemand, no one. Yeah, and I hope that answers it a bit.
Yeah, this poem is, it's such a great one. It's from his collection Niemand's Rose, which the term no one's rose, it shows up in the poem. It's one of my favorites. I love Ceylan, and I evangelize him incredibly to everyone I know. And on this podcast, everyone reads Ceylan. Another question I have relates to Hurricane Katrina, especially because, you know, natural disasters, as we call them, even though in post-Katrina discourse, it's the idea is that the hurricane wasn't the disaster; it was the lack of preparedness on the city, and as well as the government not responding immediately enough or correctly. But we still call this an act of God. So, how does that work with the idea of the un-God and especially in relation to the poetry that you're working with in this section?
So there's, and I quote this, I believe, at the beginning of the On God chapter. I'm just going to locate it, but it's this idea that we sometimes will blame God and use this excuse of it was God's will, instead of taking responsibility for our own actions. I can't find it, but it's that idea that God is used as an excuse for our actions. And you see God being blamed or God being pedestaled, like one or the other or anything in between in these poems, but this idea that, especially in terms of Katrina, right, and you mentioned already, there were so many things that led to it. And this idea of who is in the privileged here, who is in the privileged space of a city in Katrina, when Katrina happens, where were the levees not strong enough to hold the floodwaters, right? And then all the kind of race and class issues that are part of that question and part of its answer. And maybe I lost the train of thought now, but maybe if you repeat your question or if there's something I haven't covered.
No, I think that does, that goes to it, the idea that, you know, we can't call on God after a crisis always, but the idea of calling on God or apostrophizing perhaps even a deictic God, not a deity, but a deictic. How does that, or that allows us to shift the blame. We don't have to take responsibility for the crisis. We can just say it was natural and we don't have to respond. But the poetry you work with says otherwise. It highlights that fact that, you know, it's not an act of God. This is, or it's not solely an act of God. It's an act of un-God, but it's also an act of people.
Mm-hmm. And Katie Ford's poem in that chapter, in her poem Flee, she says, and it's like, it's light, which is like kind of like an approximation to God in this poem. And she says, the line, I gave you each other, so save each other. And it's like, as if God is turning away and saying like, this, it's now God saying, it's not us saying, God, it's your fault, or it's an act of God. It's God saying, this is your fault. Like, you're responsible. Now act and do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think empathy in terms of that, in terms of action, is actually like quite interesting, and not always like empathy doesn't always lead to action, and it's problematic. It can be problematic.
Yeah, that's a realization that we have to come to terms with throughout the reading of this text, that all the empathy in the world doesn't mean anything if it doesn't inspire anything beyond empathy.
Yeah, maybe I can do that. If we have time, can I share another anecdote?
Yeah, feel free.
Paul Bloom has this wonderful book called Against Empathy. And the title is like very contentious, obviously, but if you read it, you see that it's like the subtitle is The Case for Rational Compassion. But the reason I bring it up is because in that book, he recounts an anecdote that he read from Jonathan Glover. And the anecdote is about a woman who lived near to, in Nazi Germany, near to the death camps. And from her window, she was able to see atrocities being perpetuated. So she could see prisoners being killed and tortured. And she was so distraught by this that she wrote a letter to the camp officials. And she said, I can't take this. Like, I can't take witnessing this. I'm physically like ill watching this. I request that you discontinue this at once, or else do it where I don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that letter, it always stuck with me. And I thought it was so powerful because it just goes to show that even though she had empathy, she felt like literally she felt sick watching the people being tortured, but her empathy led to no action. Like, she was just as satisfied if the torture and the killings would take place outside of her sight.
Yeah, there's a limit to empathy. And at some point, it's just as if we have to say, I can't do this anymore. I can't see this anymore. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean I don't want it to happen.
Yeah, and that's a good point about like the capacities of witnessing and how that also has its limits. I mean, even, and I don't talk about my own empathy too much in this book, but even reading these works, there were works I had to, like, especially Reznikov's Holocaust, like, there were works I could only read a few pages of at a time because they were so difficult to encounter, even as a removed witness.
That Charles Reznikov's book is intense. I had to read it for class 1 year, and it's a hard one to read because he doesn't make any language flowery, or there's no metaphor. It's the direct witnessing. And I think Paul Celan in another poem, he writes that no one witnesses for the witness. So there's a question of, you know, what happens after I read these poems? And I think that what you get at is that there's an impetus to do something, to make sure that other crises don't happen, or to lessen their effects, or to just be with others. And I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a responsibility, both like to the writers writing like as secondary witnesses, but also to the readers. There's a section in my conclusion about to the reader and like asking for the reader not to just be like a surveyor of the content of this book, but to a certain extent empathize, but to and I use empathy because almost there's not another word other than potentially compassion. Like, what do you do when the term empathy is problematic itself? And they say, like, there's been talk about how compassion, which means feeling, so empathy means feeling into, whereas compassion means feeling with. It's a lot less of an invasive sort of process. And so maybe that's an alternative. Something like Dominic LaCrapper talks about empathic unsettlement. So this idea of being disturbed by the content or the object of empathy, but remaining in yourself, knowing that you are still removed from it. So there are various ways in which I guess we can conceptualize alternatives to empathy. But there is, I think, a responsibility in terms of response.
Yeah, I have nothing to add. I agree. Well, I have one final question, and you kind of gesture towards it at the end of the text, and you've given a little hint maybe at the beginning, but what are you thinking about now? Where are you going in your research, or have you taken a new route? Are you on a different road? Are you moving on from empathy? What's on your mind?
So I once went to a Leonard Cohen concert, and this sounds like it has nothing to do with it, but I'll connect it. And at the end of it, he left and came back for so many encores. And then he said, like at the end of, I think one of the last ones, he said, I tried to leave you, but I couldn't. And that's kind of how I feel about empathy. Like I thought I could leave it maybe potentially, but I almost couldn't. Like I felt there were so many other ways in which I could explore it. So what I'm working on now is still empathy. And it is still poetry, but it's I'm focusing in on the Holocaust, and I actually have like the honor to work on the show. So the Shoah Foundation has it was actually a Steven Spielberg project to record testimonies from Holocaust survivors. And now it's expanded to survivors and other kinds of witnesses, not just survivors, but other witnesses of multiple different genocides. So the Visual History Archives, I'm working with it, and I'm listening to oral Holocaust testimonies, and particularly survivors who read their own poems during the testimonies. And so like listening to poetry is a different experience than reading poetry. And listening to poetry in the context of a testimony can be like quite interesting in terms of the implications for empathy, which is what I'm looking at. And also in this project, I am thinking more about my own empathy as what we discussed as a witness, and my own responsibility as a witness to not overstep, but to find kind of where to place myself in that research. So that's kind of the work that I'm doing now. So it is the work that I proposed in that final conclusion, and I feel very fortunate to be doing it.
Well, that sounds like a really interesting project. And I hope that when it comes out and in whatever form it is, maybe we can have you back and talk more about empathy and get to even more topics that we couldn't get to today.
Thank you. That would be wonderful.
So once again, we were talking with Anna Vaprinska, whose book Empathy in Contemporary Poetry After Crisis is out through Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you, Anna, for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much, Britt, and thank you for your really fascinating, interesting, and incisive questions.
And thank you for listening to the New Books Network, New Books in Literary Studies channel. Once again, I'm your host, Britt Edelin. Until next time.